and welcome to the Sunday Salon, the podcast that celebrates brilliant books and the women who write them. Now, my guest this week is someone that I've wanted to interview for absolutely ages. Ever since her debut novel, My Name is Leon, was published in 2016, Kit Duval has been one of the most thoughtful and interesting voices in the industry. Having crowdfunded and edited an anthology of working-class memoir, Common People, she has spoken frequently of the need for publishing to become more diverse. In response to the pandemic, she co-founded the Big Book Weekend, a virtual festival, in May. And now she's published a collection of short stories, supporting cast, which revisits some of the characters from her previous works. We spoke about all of this and more, including how she became an author in her 50s, why coming to publishing late made her a better writer, and why we should all be less snobby about audiobooks. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Kit, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the Sunday Salon. It's such an honour to have you on the podcast.
Thanks very much for asking me. It's a privilege. I'm really pleased to be here.
I've got lots of questions for you, as you know, but I wonder if I can start, because we're doing this remotely, as I have been doing with all my guests since March. I wonder if I can start by asking a little bit about sort of where you are at the moment and what your lockdown has been like.
Sure. Well, I'm in my writer's room, which is at the back of my flat, which is on the ground floor. I overlook a tiny little courtyard, which was my outside space over lockdown. And it's a room that's sort of all brick, so it's got lots of exposed brick, lots of natural light, it's got lots of books on the craft of writing. Not many novels, but lots on the craft. And during lockdown, actually, I, with Molly Flatt of The Bookseller, put together the Big Book Weekend, which was a 3-day online free book festival, where we got lots of the content from all the festivals that had to cancel, and we scheduled them online, and we did that with the BBC and the Arts Council, and it was a fantastic success. We had 24,000 viewers, and we had some fantastic big names like Bernardine Evaristo, Alexander McCall Smith, Maggie O'Farrell. We had so many great writers and lots of new unknown writers, lots of women, obviously. And it was a fantastic success. It did unfortunately mean that I sat down for 6 weeks solid on my backside, and I have never been so uncomfortable in my life. But I had to do it to just, you know, Molly and I, both of us had to throw everything at it, because we actually achieved it from the first tweet where I moaned about so many festivals cancelling to the first event was 7 weeks, and it took an enormous amount of pulling together, but we did it. And it was probably the best thing I did with such a short period of time. It was great.
How amazing. And it's so interesting because there have been lots of kind of innovations during this period with how people talk about books and talk to book lovers. Do you think some of them will stay with us? Or do you think once, I mean, say we get a vaccine, which is obviously the best case scenario, say we get a vaccine, will we just go back to how we were, or do you think some of the changes will stay?
I think a lot of the changes will stay, because some of this people going online and providing more digital content, particularly as regards with books, is something that people have been thinking about and grappling with for a long time. And what the lockdown did was accelerate the speed at which people had to respond to the lockdown and had to respond to putting things online and really engaging with an audience that consumes things online. There's lots and lots of younger people, for example, who are much more likely to go to a TED talk or go to something, you know, piece of video, Snapchat, Instagram, YouTube, to get their information and their entertainment. And books can't lag behind that. Books have got to engage with that. So of course there's audiobooks, which are fantastic, but there's lots of other ways to get people to engage with books. And in fact, the second Big Book Weekend that we're doing next year. And obviously we've had to learn as we go along. We've had to learn about technology. We've had to engage with technology. We've had to look at how we present information about books, but do it digitally and through author interviews. And we're really going to build on that for the next one. And I mean, you know, we would be mad, anyone would be mad, not to see the potential in having 24,000 visitors to your book festival, which is, you know, a lot more than go to many live festivals. So I think the digital world and the engagement with publishing books and literacy is definitely here to stay, even outside of lockdown. And I also think that lockdown in some form will reemerge from time to time. And I think we'll be much, much more able and, you know, to be nimble in our response to it than we were the first time around. I mean, like I say, we somehow got it together very quickly. And I think now people are thinking, right, how do we harness the online world and make it work for us?
So we are talking just before Supporting Cast is released, but by the time this is out, people will be able to go and buy it. And I was interested, for you promoting a book, how strange has that been doing it under these restrictions? I mean, things like bookshops are now open, but how have you found it? Has it been disappointing, or has it in some ways been quite nice?
It's different. I mean, I'm very sort of tech savvy, and I'm a great fan of audiobooks and consuming books in many, many different forms. So I read ebooks, I listen to audiobooks, I read hard copy books, I go to author events all the time, and I support other authors, and I teach. So, you know, there's lots of different ways that I engage. And I also do things like this, podcasts and online interviews. So for me, promoting my book and telling people about Supporting Cast, it feels quite natural for me to be talking and doing most of it online. I suppose, have had a book launch if I've been able to. And there won't be a book launch. I'll be on the day waiting to see, you know, people are saying they've read it and loved it. And we've had a few reviews in which have been absolutely fantastic, better than I could ever have hoped. So for me, it's great. I love promoting. I love talking about my work. Obviously, every author loves talking about their work. And people have been, generally speaking, very supportive. And I've done a lot of interviews online, and I've done a lot of written interviews for newspapers and so forth. So to be honest, I haven't noticed that much of a difference.
So there's a few things that you said there that I actually want to come back to. I'm very interested in asking you about audiobooks, actually. I knew you were a fan. Yeah. But and I also, you know, of course, want to ask you a little bit more about the book. But before I do, can I just ask you a little bit of background? Because you are very interesting in that you actually came to writing and publishing quite late in life. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood and what role reading played in that? I was very taken with something you said. At home, we had a narrow choice of reading matter, the News of the World that my Caribbean father brought home every Sunday, or a daily dose of the Bible from my Irish mother. Can you tell me about reading as a child?
Sure. Well, the only reading I did was what we were forced to do at school. I was not a reader by any stretch of the imagination. I would never have read a book at home. I never wanted to. I felt they were almost a form of punishment. And like I say, there were two things to read in the house, the News of the World or the Bible. And neither of those, I mean, there were some nice racy bits in the News of the World, I can remember, you know, and they still days had page three, which I thought was shocking and scandalous, but I nevertheless looked. And the Bible was just purgatory. So when I was at school and we read, and in those days you read in rote around the class where you'd read 5 pages each, that was torture. You know, it's so slow that you almost forgot what you were reading. So I wouldn't read at all, and I never read a book until I was in my early 20s. I wasn't interested in them at all. In my early 20s, then I completely got hooked. But I often hear people say, oh, you know, if children don't read, you know, they won't turn to books. And of course it's important for children to read. But, you know, there are parents really should relax a little bit about it, because sometimes the books find the children as opposed to the children finding the books. And it can just be that children come to reading in a roundabout way or a circuitous route or just by accident. And I see a lot of parents really freaking out about the fact that their child won't pick up a book. And I never did. and, you know, it certainly did me no harm.
So when the kind of the reading found you, so to speak, what was it that got you hooked? What kind of reading?
I wanted to read because I was bored after a pretty wild life that I'd stopped. And I asked my boss at the time to recommend some books, and he recommended 10 classics. I didn't know there were classics. I wouldn't even have known what a classic was. But he recommended 10 books. And so I just went and bought the 10 books and read them. And they all happened to be classics. I mean, they were all great, don't get me wrong, but some of them really, really fascinated me, like Thérèse Racan by Emile Zola and Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert. And those two I can remember out of all of the ones I read really captured my imagination. And I then just went on and read hundreds of classics because that's what I thought a good book was. I then sort of branched out into finding my own theme, my own taste in literature, which it took a long time because I just really wanted to work my way through all of these books that I just thought, wow, you know, all these books I'd missed out on, like all of Graham Greene's books and Vanity Fair and the classics, Dickens, everything. And I devoured them. I loved them. But then, you know, got a bit more discriminating, found out what I liked from what I didn't like, and pursued it from there.
And you went to university to do an MA in creative writing at the age of 51, and you've written, at 16, I got a job as a typist, then a filing clerk, then an office manager, a paralegal in criminal and family law, a project manager in social services, a massage therapist, waitress and backing singer, became a member of the employment tribunal, the adoption panel, and then a magistrate. I had a busy life, so when I eventually started writing, I felt I had something to say. Do you think that that has been very important to your identity as a writer? The fact that, I mean, we often hear about like politicians, for example, and people talk about, oh, you know, someone's either spent their entire life being a professional politician or they've actually had a life outside. And it's interesting in the context of writing. Do you feel that having had a sort of pre-author life has been an advantage in your writing?
I do, because, you know, if you have all these different jobs as I had and a quite strange upbringing, it forces you into the company of lots of different people. So you are intimately acquainted with different lifestyles and views and people's ways of living and what people believe and what people are like. And that's so good for character development. You know, if you're looking to write about characters, it's important that you have a lot of different characters in your own life to pull on. To say, oh, that's what that feels like. That's what that person looks like. That's why that person does that. And for me, I am so glad I've had that life. I'm so glad I've met and genuinely loved so many different people from different walks of life. It's very, very important to me. And it's certainly informed what I write about and who I write about and where my interests are. That's not to say that when you get older, you automatically get this take on life or that you automatically become wise or you automatically have more of a writer or you're a better writer, because that's not true. It's definitely true of me. But I have read books by young writers that are absolutely fantastic and wise beyond their years. For me, it was necessary. I wouldn't have been a good writer in my 20s, not at all. But it's not, as I say, it's not an automatic thing, because it depends on who the person is and where they're coming from and what their interests are and how they're able to channel the stuff that's in their heart and get it onto the page.
It's so interesting because, you know, I hear from a lot of young writers who sort of have this idea of, oh, I want a book by 30, or feel almost like they've missed the boat if they sort of reach a certain stage and they haven't published something yet. And I remember, you know, Isabel Allende, when she came on the podcast, she, like you said, that she came to writing late and that was an advantage to her. So I think it's a really refreshing message for people to hear that there's no rush.
Absolutely, there's no rush. And also, there are other things to do with your life. Of course, if you've had this dream that you want to be a writer and it's sort of deep within your soul and you think, oh my God, that's all I ever want to do, that's great. But there are other things to do with your life. There are other things to do with writing. There are other ways to express your creativity, and nothing is wasted. No experience in your life is wasted. No relationship is wasted. No job is wasted. There's nothing that happens to you that is a pointless thing, or that is, it might distract you from your writing for a while. You know, maybe if you're a woman, you might have children, or you might find that you can only write an hour a day when you used to be able to write 6 hours a day, or you might have a completely engrossing career that takes a lot of emotional energy. But it's not wasted. There will be a time when you can call on those experiences. And there'll be a time when you'll be really, really glad that something happened to you, or you had that broken heart, or you missed that boss, or whatever it is. You can call on those experiences, put them into your work. Nothing's wasted.
And did you find studying creative writing helpful? It's often, you know, for some reason, it's often a point of controversy. You get people who are very critical of creative writing degrees, and obviously lots of people who love them as well. And we've had lots of people who've done them on the podcast. How did you find that helpful to your kind of development?
The best thing about the creative writing degree was the indicator to myself that it was an important thing. So I left school, I was actually 15 when I left school, and I'd never been to university and I never missed it. But when I discovered writing, I knew I had to learn the craft, and I knew that this was so important that I was going to consider going to university. So it gave me the opportunity of spending a year concentrating on writing and nothing else. I gave up my job to do it. I also met the most fantastic people, the sort of people that you could sit down and talk about a comma with, or talk about a character with for ages, who were really supportive of your work. I don't think my creative writing MA was the best. There were lots of things I would do differently. There was lots of ways that I would reorganise that MA and make it different and better. But for me, it was a turning point in how I viewed writing, in that I saw it as a what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, as opposed to, oh, this is going to be something that I hope I'll be good at. For me, it was a moment of realising how serious it was for me. But I certainly do not think that you have to have a creative writing MA to succeed, or that you have to do a creative writing MA to learn the craft. There's many ways. You do have to learn the craft. Everyone, I do believe, has to learn the craft. But there's lots of ways of doing it. And a £10,000 or £9,000 creative writing degree is a real challenge for lots of people. And if you are struggling with money, then I would suggest that you find other ways of learning the craft, through short courses or reading, or forming a group of you that can discuss things like point of view or psychic distance or whatever it is. Creative writing degrees are fabulous if you can afford them, and if you've got the time and you choose a good one. And if not, there are lots of other ways that you can learn the information that you'd get on a creative writing degree.
Your debut novel, My Name is Leon, was published in 2016, and it was published to a six-way auction between publishers, and then clocked up all sorts of acclaim. It was shortlisted for the Costa Book Award and the Desmond Elliott Prize. It won the Irish Novel of the Year Award in 2017. What was it like to have your first piece of work met with such a reception? Was it purely just a sort of wonderful thing and isn't this amazing, or was it also quite strange and challenging in its own ways?
It was strange because I'm very, very new to publishing. You know, my first novel only came out 4 years ago, and I didn't understand the publishing industry at all. I didn't know about launches and publishers and editors and jackets and design and podcasts and all that sort of stuff about books. It was just completely beyond me. So I don't think I realised, maybe for a couple of years, how extreme that reaction was. I knew that I was really surprised at the reception that I got, and it all did feel like a bit of a whirlwind. But I think it was only maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, that I thought, oh my God, that was amazing. Because I've seen friends of mine who have had books out who haven't had that reception, and other books that I've thought were great that didn't get that reception. And so I know I was extremely lucky and extremely privileged to have had the attention and the acclaim and the readership that I had. You know, I think it's a good book and I'm sure it's a good book. But I also do know that some of it's a luck and some of it is who's championing you. You know, I consider myself extremely fortunate to have had that response to my work.
You have been very vocal about the whole publishing industry's need to be more inclusive. And in fact, more than being vocal, you've been very dynamic on it. You crowdfunded and edited the Common People anthology, an anthology of working class memoir. You have set up the Kit Dwal Creative Writing Scholarship at Birkbeck University. Can you tell me why you've done that and when you became aware that the industry did have this problem with inclusivity and access?
I became aware when I got published. So when I found myself being published, I was aware that everyone I spoke to in the industry was posh, middle class. A lot of people, most people were white, most people were in London. And I did wonder, even when I was reading all these classics in my 20s, I did wonder where the working class writers were. There were certainly writers writing about the working classes, like Dickens, like Arnold Bennett, like George Orwell, but they weren't themselves working class. And it surprised me that there weren't more people from my background. And I've sort of become a spokesperson for it, and I know that people consider me an activist. But actually, when I was asking the question, I was genuinely asking the question, where are the working class writers? I didn't know there was the sort of issues that they were with access and being published if you're from working class background. I did a documentary for Radio 4 and I wrote some articles about it. And yes, it is an issue. And academics have studied it and published papers about it. So it's, you know, it's a genuine issue and one that is being addressed. And I do believe it's being addressed. And I do think things are changing. There needs to be a continued push and a continued willingness by the industry to engage with it on the long term. But yes, it's definitely harder for working class writers to get published, to get into the industry, to get noticed, to have their work valued, to access networking events and everything, most of which happen in London. So there are, you know, multiple barriers to working class writers having their work out there.
Can I ask about your enthusiasm for audiobooks? And in fact, you mentioned as well ebooks earlier. Do you think that there's too much, I suppose, cultural snobbery bound up in how we approach reading sometimes? I often feel a bit guilty if I listen to an audiobook as opposed to reading it. I then don't feel like I can say I've read it. And, you know, seeing as we've been talking about the barriers to access in the industry, I wonder if it's kind of part and parcel of the same thing in a way. It's just making things less accessible.
Absolutely. When people say you haven't read it, if you haven't read it, I mean, I don't know if I can swear on your podcast, but it's...
Yes, please do.
Bollocks. You are absorbing the information. The information in the book is what the book was written for, not the black ink on the white page. That's not an idea. The black ink on the white page is not an idea. It's not going to move you. The words themselves move you, however you absorb them. So, you know, if you have a phone call with someone, you can cry and be affected by that phone call as much as if you're sitting with someone giving you the information. Of course, it's different in the way that radio is different from television, the way that podcasts are different from anything else. But you are still moved by ideas, by what the author intended for you to absorb. Audiobooks are so important for people that can't read, that are worried about reading, that feel very vulnerable. They look at a big, thick book and they think, I can't get through that book, or I don't know what that means, or I don't know how to pronounce that. And they're, you know, they can be embarrassed about their reading habits. audiobooks breaks down that barrier, and it can take the most complex book and the most complex ideas. And it's not that they're simplified, it's just that they're given to somebody in a way that they can absorb them. And there's research now that demonstrates that exactly the same part of the brain lights up, if you like, you know, responds to written material or audible material. The same material affects us in the same way. The snobbery, of course, comes from people that are super literate, that have been brought up in a home stuffed with leather-bound books, who see books as being, you know, and reading being a very worthwhile activity. That, you know, to see their children curled up in a window seat with a copy of Philip Pullman's book is just about every parent's dream. Well, the same children can get the same information from Philip Pullman. And in fact, Philip Pullman's audiobook last year, which was narrated by Michael Sheen, which was absolutely fabulous, won an award for audiobook of the year, because some of those audiobooks are performances. They can excite children in the way that the written word can't. My own child had dyslexia and couldn't read, and he managed to keep up with all of his friends reading. He was reading exactly the same that they were reading, but by audiobook, read by Stephen Fry or read by famous actors. And so he could go to school and talk to his peers about what was happening in the book the same way as though he'd sat down and read it. And of course, audiobooks are the only books you can read with your eyes closed if you're tired. So I do consider myself having read the books. If I've listened to the audiobook, absolutely I do. And I think people shouldn't be ashamed or think it's anything, you know, like a second-rate way of absorbing information.
What made you want to put out a collection of short stories? You've been writing short stories for a while, but what made you want to focus solely on them?
I wanted to write these short stories because I hadn't finished with some of the characters.
I love that idea of revisiting them.
I just hadn't, you know, I used to think about them when the book was over, and I'd go to literary festivals and people say, you didn't say what happened to Carol or what happened to Carl or whatever, for, you know, characters from my books. And it was an absolute joy and a luxury to be able to sit down with these characters again and go, gosh, what happened to you? And feel like they were saying to me, God, you'll never believe it. This is what happened. Or that's who I became. Or this is how I died. It was sheer bliss, and I absolutely had to stop myself. That book would have been three times the size if I hadn't sort of wound it back and just thought, hang on a minute, not every character can get to speak.
How do you differ as a writer when you're writing short stories? Is it a totally different experience?
No, it's not a different experience. Obviously, when you're writing a novel, you have to sustain threads and storylines and images and plots for a lot longer. So that just becomes a matter of persistence and energy. You know, it just takes a lot more from you to write a novel. The skills are exactly the same in that you have to have your characters, you have to make your characters believable, you have to give them a personality, you have to give them a narrative arc, you have to have a plot, you have to have a crisis, you have to have a beginning. So all the skills as far as storytelling are exactly the same. It's just one is can be over. For example, in supporting cast, there are some stories that are a page long, so that narrative arc can be over and done with in 500 words, or it would be 50,000 or 100,000 words. It's just how long you sustain the energy of the novel.
One of the things that is very interesting about short stories, I think, is similar to the audiobook and particularly the audiobook discussion we were having, they can be so much more accessible to people, particularly when we've got so many demands on our attention. Were you conscious of that when you were writing it, that this was a way for people to perhaps engage in literature in a more accessible way?
It wasn't, to be honest. No, I didn't think, oh, you know, this will just suit the way we read now, because short stories and particularly flash fiction has been, you know, we've been saying that for years, that this is how people, you know, absorb things now in these little sort of sound bites, if you like. And of course, you know, it does help to, if you've only got a certain amount of time and you want to read a complete story. But the converse is true. Some people want to lose themselves completely in a book. They don't want it to be over quickly. They want that long, sustained pleasure, like the difference between watching, you know, an episode of something and watching a complete movie. Sometimes, you know, they're both as valid as one another. I think audiobooks particularly help people that have to travel a lot, and I used to have to travel a great deal, or people that have got such busy lives that they can have a chapter while they're washing up or ironing or whatever. You know, that's the beauty of things, that you can do two things at the same time and multitask, like so many of us have to do these days.
Can I ask a little bit about yourself as a writer, your writing routine? You mentioned you were in your writing room.
Yeah.
Is that, do you have to be there to write, and do you have particular times of day or particular rituals you have to adhere to?
No, not at all. I don't write every day, because sometimes I've got nothing to say and I don't care if I don't write every day. And in fact, I haven't written for my novel, I've written articles, but I haven't written anything in my latest novel for about 2 weeks, because it's just not there, and it will be there. You have to trust that process. I don't have to be in here. I love going away to write. I love going away somewhere, but there's no internet access. That helps. So I don't check Twitter too often. And I like going away with friends to write, so that, you know, it might be a 3-bedroom cottage or something that we'll hire, and we'll all be in our different rooms, and then we'll come together at dinner. I love doing that. Or I can write in a cafe. I can write anywhere, basically. For me, it's much more about, have I got anything to say, rather than where I am. And the only ritual I have, I suppose, is that I write in the evening. I write my best stuff, my creative stuff, in the evening. I could write an essay or something in the daytime. But when I'm writing my novel, I will normally start about 7 or 8 and go through to 2 or 3 in the morning.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
Because the world goes quiet. There's a sort of drop in the register of the world. Things quieten down, and the later it gets, the quieter it gets, and I feel I can listen to me more. I can sort of dredge things up more. I don't feel like there's so many other pulls on my time. I love, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning is such a good time to write. There's a real special still an emotional quality to that time.
You're obviously busy promoting supporting cast at the moment, but you mentioned you were also working on another book. What is next for you after this?
I'm writing a novel, which I'm coming towards the end of the first draft. It's got a long, long way to go before it's ready. I'm also preparing to do the second big book weekend next winter, sort of February time. That's taking up a lot of time at the moment. Because we want it to be great, and we particularly want to focus on getting more people to engage with books, which is what it's for. And I'm also doing some script writing. So I've done one script, which for a programme that'll be out sometime in September. And I'm working on a couple of others as well.
Wow. That's very, very exciting. And so yeah. lots of different things on the go.
Yeah. Yes.
We're running out of time, so I'm going to let you go in a second. But before I do, just one final question, which I ask everyone who comes on, which is, if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say it's all right. Everything's all right. Stop worrying. I'm a great worrier, and certainly I'm less of a worrier now than I used to be. But when I was young, I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness, which is quite an oppressive religion. And I thought I would die before I was 16. And so I spent a long time waiting to die, or waiting for things to catch up with me. And I would say to my 16-year-old, you're not going to die. Everything's going to be fine.
That is very Very good advice and a great note to end on. Kit, thank you so much for your time. You've been absolutely fascinating to speak to, and I wish we had 2 hours more because there's so much I would ask you more about. But thank you very, very much. And to everyone listening, Supporting Cast is out now. So that's it from us. Thank you for listening to The Sunday Salon. Please do share your thoughts about the episode with me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Alice Azania. And more importantly, if you are enjoying the show, please do think about leaving a rating or review, because they're very important for exposing the show to new people. And I also love getting them when they're nice. So thank you very much. And until next week, goodbye.